It starts vibrating, and then in the distance, a shark flew out of the water.
This is Up Up Down Down, the show about the art and craft of video games. I'm Alan Pike. Joining us today is Nigel Brook, a 15-year veteran of the games industry, having worked for Radical Entertainment, later Activision. He's now co-founder of Steam Clock Software. Hi, Nigel.
Hello.
Also joining us today is John Walker. John has written for many gaming outlets, including PC Gamer and The Escapist, and is editor and co-director of fan PC gaming site Rock Paper Shotgun. Hi, John.
Hello.
Excited to have you with us on this Super Bowl Sunday. We've got two Canadians and an American who do not really care, or I assume you don't care, so it's perfect.
This is when you play the American football, right?
Yeah, there's the American football and then the Canadian football and then there's the British football, none of which overlap very much, but in fandom, I imagine. So our topic today is the future of PC gaming, which is potentially very broad, so we'll see where it leads us. But I thought it was a really good topic having John on. Some people might not fully realize if they read Rock, Paper, Shotgun, sort of on and off or are linked to it, that it's a PC exclusive site, which I was kind of reading a little bit on the about and stuff like that. And I saw a funny message like, stop sending us all these mobile games and console games to review. Like,
they have
PC
stopped.
Gaming right in the header.
It's every day. It's so many iOS code links for us.
Check out our social mobile game. It'll be great.
And also an enormous amount of email about Valve-based products for engineering.
Oh, that's interesting. Mm. Like things for modding games, you mean?
No. Things for like machinery, Steam.
Like actual physical.
Oh. Steam buckets. A lot of requests for Steam buckets. I don't know what a Steam bucket is, but people keep wanting to buy them from me.
Oh my God. That's amazing.
There must be some Google search term that that's like Steam Valve related, because obviously there's report on the game that just some perfect storm of Google searches, and they like Steam Valves, and it's like Rock, Paper, Shotgun.
Oh, yes.
They totally have got Steam Valves covered.
That's amazing. I just Googled Steam Bucket, and Rock, Paper, Shotgun isn't on the first page, but it might be in some way. One thing that happens sometimes when I'm trying to figure out, like, why am I getting this bizarre Google result in my like statistics? And it'll because I'll be like the top Google image result for wet floor sign or some totally random thing. And so then people are emailing me about wet floor signs. So I think an interesting sort of subtopic about sort of the future of the PC and how it's been changing in recent years is early access. Which is, and I hadn't actually fully absorbed this, even though it's really obvious, but you'd mentioned it on email, is that early access obviously is something that's been changing a lot, you know, what sort of games are being made and how people perceive the game development process, but it's something that's happening exclusively on the PC. And when I say PC in the context of this episode, I'm talking about Windows and Mac, but it's happening on the PC and the console basically. Every once in a while, they're like, oh, it's Titanfall beta because we haven't worked out our server problems, but it's basically the final game, more or less. And so, I don't know, what's your take, John, on how early access has been changing this sort of landscape of what games are out there and people are making?
I think, like so many new developments or new ways of approaching gaming, it's this great spread of good and bad. There's certainly those who are abusing the system, who are putting out barely started or half finished games that they're probably never going to finish and being able to charge, you know, the $15-$20 for it, getting that money and then never actually getting a finished version of the game made. That's the way it can be abused. But at the same time, what's happening is amazing community projects are rising up. Developers are putting out the framework of a game and then the community's coming in and saying, hey, but what if it did this? Or, oh, I'd love this, but if only it did this. And they're able to start bringing that stuff in and seeing how it works. And people are investing in a game as it develops and then getting an end result that they've been a part of the development for.
It definitely seems like it provides an opportunity that's never really existed before for people to be a part of that process in a way that kind of scales. where the final work of art, if we all agree that it's a work of art, that they had some voice in making that what it is. You know, film and TV and all the previous things obviously were made mostly in a vacuum. I guess in a TV series, if everyone's writing in, they're saying like, wow, that Fonz guy is really funny. And then pretty quickly he maybe becomes more important in the series, but not in the sort of direct way where, you know, people do with early access. But on the other hand, like I've seen a fair amount of this sort of negative side where people are, you know, making an early access game, you know, making a game, they run out of money, so it becomes early access, but then it's a game that isn't necessarily that well suited to early access, and then you end up with a bunch of people who are entitled and angry at them, but they're just like honest people trying to make a game, and then people are like, I don't know, giving them weird feedback, and then they have to, then, you know, there's all sorts of weird things when you're an indie dev, especially that doesn't have a PR department to filter all that stuff.
It's sort of the same problem that Kickstarter has, right? Is that, I mean, that's the same niche that's filling, is this way to give money because you want something to exist as opposed to because it already exists and you're going to get it. But as with Kickstarter, there's, you know, people have a sense of entitlement to the project that's somewhat out of proportion with
$15.
The reality, right? That, yeah, you've given these people your $15 and they've given you their beta game, and maybe not enough people are going to give them money for them to finish it, or maybe they're not talented enough to finish it, or maybe there's just some fundamental problem with it that they can't make their original design work. And, you know, I think you should go into that stuff with kind of an open mind of like, I'm potentially paying $15 for something that's not going to be any good, or that I'm not going to get what I'm expecting in the end. And maybe people sort of intellectually know that, but I think people have, you know, they still have that attachment. They still think like, hey, I've got my $15 and you need to give me exactly the thing I imagined for that $15. And so when it doesn't happen, people are pissed off, as opposed to people just sort of saying, you know, well, okay, well, that looked cool, but it turned out not to be cool. Oh, well.
I agree. And I think my appeal for Kickstarter is that people perceive it as angel investment. It's not pre-ordering. It's backing a project with the hope that it will work out, but not actually paying for the end result. Whereas I think with early access, there's a much more definitive sense of buying the product. It's a promise that early access is okay. We're this far on with the game. You can buy it now rather than later. And I think there should be a much greater sense of expecting to receive the promised results. Whereas Kickstarter is very much more openly, we don't know. This is an idea. We'll see where this goes.
Yeah, I was interested to see Space DF9, which was I don't know if they had a Kickstarter as well as an early access. It was actually like a Double Fine game, I believe. And so like well-established studio and like very, you know, talented people on it. But it was like, oh, we want to try the simulation genre, which is a genre I quite like and is obviously well-suited to the PC. And they're kind of describing it's going to be this base, you know, space station and space and blah, blah, blah. And it's going to be experimental and you're going to tell us what you think and stuff like that. And so they worked on it for, I don't know if it was 1 or 2 years, but it was basically the exact amount of time they promised they would work on it for. And then they're like, well, sales aren't high enough to justify keep working on this, so we're going to declare it done in 1 month, and then we'll have 1.0, and then everyone will be happy. And people were not happy because they talked about, oh, wouldn't it be cool if we added this, or wouldn't it be cool if we added like away missions to planets? And they were like, oh, yeah, that would be cool. But then they're like, oh, well, you know, not enough sales happening, so it doesn't make sense to add those things, which is totally what they should do, because they, you know, that's why Double Fine is still in business after 20 years of sometimes not always having the biggest hits. but still people get frustrated by that.
It was tough with that game as well. They put a lot of money into it. As far as I know, there wasn't a Kickstarter on that one, I don't believe. I think it was just early access.
And I'm looking at the Wikipedia page and I don't see anything about a Kickstarter. So I think, yeah. I think it was just the early access was the only early funding.
And they realized they were making a loss with this project, and they couldn't see a way to make a gain with it. And so at that point they had to move on, and they had created what they had promised they'd create. The list of extra content for it was heavily explained. This is potential. None of this is promised. And yet it's still, I think what it did is, while I don't think Double Fine did anything wrong, I think what they did is highlight the problems with this model and highlight how people need to give it more thought before they invest in such projects.
Yeah, it's especially problematic because the games that are a good fit for, you know, it's actually now the more that we talk about this, I realize that Kickstarter and Early Access have a lot of similarities in that you're paying for the game before it's made. And then both of them have a lot of appeal to people who are working in niche genres that are of questionable profitability, that people like the idea of, but why does no one make a game about this? You know, why don't they make these kind of games anymore? Because of that, it kind of they're at a substantial more risk of creating the game and then maybe not making a lot of sales, and maybe it's not that sustainable compared to you don't see as many early access Kickstarter projects for like, oh, we're going to make a first person shooter that's in World War II, and you go around and you shoot zombies, you know, and that's probably not going to actually get funded also. So
it's extraordinary. You highlight a real discrepancy, which is the projects which people would be willing to fund and games which people will actually buy. And I think there's, in the big Kickstarter boom of 2013, there was a real lack of understanding of that. People didn't think, like, so if you look at these projects, say someone, long dead adventure games developers being reanimated and reappearing back on Kickstarter, everyone who was ever going to buy that game backed the Kickstarter. And that's what people hadn't realized. There isn't an audience for classic point-and-click adventures. That's why big publishers aren't making them, or they would be. If there were money available, they would be making them. They got their whole audience backing the Kickstarter. There was no one left to buy the finished game.
Yeah, and that's hard to tell in the projections, because it's been the other way around for some other games that were sort of just indie platformers and stuff like that. Saw, oh, okay, Kickstarter, and they figured they would make, you know, half or the majority of their money with Kickstarter, and then ended up being very successful on like PSN or on Steam or whatever. But that's not necessarily the case for genres that are kind of dead.
And there's no way to know that in advance, or at least there's no way to know it without, you know, some kind of marketing organization dedicated to finding it out, right? Like the big publishers, the AAA game publishers, have a pretty good idea before they release a game how many units it's going to sell, because they've done a bunch of market research on it. Kickstarter and early access sort of look like market research in that you know, like the floor of, okay, well, at least this many people are interested in this thing because this many people backed our Kickstarter or this many people bought our early access. But it doesn't tell you anything about what the distance between the floor and the actual value is. It may be that, like you say, everyone backed the Kickstarter, and then that doesn't provide you with any additional information of, okay, if I got 1,000 people backing the Kickstarter, does that mean I can sell to 2,000 people or 10,000 people, or what does it mean? And it's different for every game. And like I said, there's probably ways you could figure that out if you were willing to pay a market research firm to find it out for you. But it's difficult to find it out by just going around and collecting up all of the super fans and counting them and saying, like, all right, let's multiply this number by some other number, and maybe that's how many people we can sell this game to.
Yeah, I think that's definitely always a problem in indie, but definitely exacerbated by early access and things like that. So in the sort of the sum, then, if we're thinking what kind of effects is early access having on what kind of games are being made, obviously there's more games being started and not finished, even though people are playing them, and there's more developers that are struggling with these things. But something I think is interesting is that the genre, the sort of set of genres that are being developed, I would say has dramatically expanded in the last like 1 to 3 years. You know, at least on, you know, PC, there's way more games with, you know, quirky concepts, and that's ones that are doing Kickstarters and early accesses, and ones that are even not, where people have a success with one game like that, and then they're funded to be trying new things. And they don't always work, but it's definitely, I feel, probably way healthier for the ecosystem than 5 or 10 years ago, when it's like, well, all of the big selling games are first-person shooters, and all of the engines support first-person shooters pretty well, so what kind of first-person shooter do you want to make?
It's interesting. I wonder whether some of the big success stories are still happening independently of that. Say, if you look at the Stanley Parable, that made two developers were millionaires literally overnight. The first night of those games, that game sold, and they were millionaires. And I'm not seeing too many early access projects quite matching that. I say that if you're making a survival sim and you're putting it on Steam's early access, you're probably going to get quite rich quite quickly, because people will buy any crap when it's just got the word survival in the title. A quick tip for anyone.
Well, part of the fun of that is that if the game is like really broken and you die a lot, that's almost like the theme of the game.
I was going to say that actually, I was thinking about, as you were talking, I was thinking about which early access games I've really enjoyed. And they have been survival games. I've played a lot of a game called Salt, which I've really enjoyed. The Forest, I've had a lot of fun with. And I've realized that I keep going back to these games because they keep patching in new content. These updates come out and there's a reason to go back and start from the beginning again. And it occurs to me that with games, both Salt and The Forest would be good examples. If those games were abandoned, if those games were never finished, I certainly got my money's worth. I've really had a lot of fun playing them at this point.
I think survival games are kind of interesting in that there's something about them that actually works really well with the early access model, in that the difficulty curve for them is very tough to figure out in advance, right? Like you're really walking this fine line. A part of the fun of the game is how brutally difficult it can be in places. And that's a tough thing to figure out the right spot to, you know, to dial your knob to without having people play it and sort of see how it goes, which I think is less true than other genres. That, you know, if you're a game designer who's making like a platformer game, like you can kind of play it and get a sense of like how difficult how difficult people are going to find it from your experience with other platforms. I think survival games, that's harder to do. They need more of that like focus group kind of research. And you know, that's the other thing about early access, is kind of indie games' version of focus groups, right? I think I've said before when talking about this topic, like it's not like the big game publishers don't do this same thing. It's just they don't do it by selling the game and getting the people who bought it to test it. They do it by like rounding up a bunch of random people and bringing them into the office and getting them to play the game, you know, for 8 hours a day over a week, and then they use that information. And, you know, this is early access is kind of indie games' version of the focus group, and survival games are a game genre that needs focus groups more than some others do, because you're walking that really fine line with the difficulty curve, that if you don't make it really brutally difficult, it's not going to be any fun, but if you go a little bit too far, then it's not going to be any fun either.
Yeah, and then definitely the permadeath restarting over and over again is way better for people. If you have a game that people are playing before it's ready, than anything that has a storyline, for example. Like they just get bored of the first level and they're like, this sucks.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, and I it's interesting how when you compare it to the big publishers and the focus group testing, they also do another thing which is very similar to early access, which is pre-ordering. Which is this massive scam that seems to have been completely bought into, where they sell a game on announcement at massive prices. You know, here you can buy the £90, $120 gift super extra double bonus version of this game that we actually haven't even finished developing opening marketing materials for. And people are totally adopting the system and committing their money to a game that will probably not be very good in 12, 18 months' time. That, I think, is a far more insidious and dangerous model that seems to be wholly accepted than early access, which is incessantly questioned.
Because it kind of is early access. It's like, we're selling this game before we even know if it's good.
Yeah, it's early access without any access. It's revolting. And it drives me crazy that pre-ordering isn't balked at in the same way that people get, you know, pull their petticoats up over their heads and anger at any mistake made by an indie doing early access.
It's also the publisher's version, the big publisher's version of the, hey, we made an early access game and it didn't work out, so we're not going to finish it, right? I don't like it, but I have a certain sympathy for people of like, if they know or think that they've got a stinker on their hands and they're like, well, we got to release it and get what money we can back, then things like pushing pre-orders or making people hold their reviews until after the release and stuff like that, like, those are, I mean, what those are is they're just cynical tactics to try and bring in more more users. And, I don't like that people use them, but I can't blame them when they're in that situation. Pre-orders, I mean, maybe pre-orders aren't as much that as, like, the hold reviews until the last possible moment stuff are. Pre-orders are also just a little bit of your standard price discrimination, right? Is if there are some people that'll pay you know, pay $120 for the game plus some little plastic figurine that cost you like $3 to make, then hey, why not collect their money in advance, right? It's not something that I like, but it's something I see where the publishers are coming from on that, is there's an uncaptured market there of people that are willing to pay more for the game. And so pre-orders are a way to get them, particularly the pre-orders with the bonuses, right? That you do the pre-orders and you get something else. It's a way to get those super fans and capture a little bit extra money from them up front. But yeah, it's definitely a cynical thing for people to do.
And it's also anti-consumer by the consumer, so it doesn't advantage anyone. The prices, they would do massive discounts on the, if you know, you get your 10% pre-order bonus. Well, that would become a first week 10% discount if there were no pre-orders, and it caused the death of the demo. There's no demos released for games anymore because everyone's already bought it before the demo could be made. It seems to have done so much harm to the audience, and the audience is the one who's perpetrating it. It makes me very sad.
The other thing with pre-orders is sort of a non-cynical thing, is that pre-orders are getting more and more important as digital distribution of big games becomes more of a thing, right? That it would be very hard to make a like 40 gig download game that you didn't have pre-orders for, right? If everyone just on like the day that, you know, the new Call of Duty was released, like, fired up their Steam clients and their, you know, the store on the PS4 and the Xbox One, and, like, all started trying to download that game, it would be a nightmare, right? So, I think you know, that's not an argument in favor of doing pre-release purchases, you know, months in advance, but it's certainly an argument in favor of doing it like a few weeks in advance. So people that know that they're going to be able to buy, that they're going to buy the game anyways, can pay and download it over the week before release, and then it just unlocks on the day of release.
I would say a few days before release, opening it up to be downloaded for free, and then you pay to unlock it on release day would be a way better way of pulling people in. If people have already committed, you know, 39 gigs of downloads to a game, they're going to be much more tempted to click yes to pay on the release day.
That actually is a disturbingly good idea. I'm kind of surprised that no one's done that.
Well, I'm sure that some accountant did the math and they're like, oh, well, this would be a more reasonable consumer-friendly thing to do. And then somebody calculated, yes, but 27% of people who would buy the game to pre-download it, then maybe would never get around to it. Or maybe hear bad reviews or just change their mind. And so we would make $73 million less. And then they veto that. Womp womp. But I mean, that's why we have competition, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah. It's just kind of weird that no one's tried that. Like it seems, I mean, I guess people do, in some sense, people do try that, in that that's sort of what all of the like free to play style games, like the genres where free to play has become the norm, even you know, not just among scammy mobile games, but things like MOBAs, like free to play seems to be kind of the way that MOBAs are done. And I guess they're kind of that way, right? That you can download it for free and you can play a little bit of it for free, and they're just counting that you're going to start paying for more of it after. But it's not a, you know, it's not a download it and you don't get anything until you unlock it scenario.
Yeah, well, I've been playing Blizzard's upcoming MOBA, the Heroes of the Storm, which will be free and is free. And I'm in this like private beta and everything is free. I mean, not everything is free. It actually has all the payment stuff already in there. So you can buy all these things in this pre-release game. But yeah, it's free, and so
like
everyone
for cash money or the,
oh, it's cash a, money. Oh yeah, oh,
okay.
And they won't refund it when the game is like final. So you're like, oh, I think this hero seems pretty awesome, and then they can nerf it or whatever. But I
do
think
you get to keep the content at least when the
yes.
game. Okay, that's something, I suppose.
Yeah, but they do reserve the right to refund, not refund, but like rescind anything that you bought in the game for in-game currency, just not for real currency.
Interesting.
But I recently saw my 8-year-old nephew playing games on a phone, and watching him play these games and just hit these paywalls, and he's 8. He doesn't have a credit card, and his mum's got more sense than to put it in. And it was really interesting for me. I'm a big fan of mobile gaming, but I really do tend to buy games. Like, I like a game that I don't mind if I'm paying £5 for a game to be able to play it. And watching an 8-year-old hit all these paywalls and just the frustration and I could see the desire to nag, and he's a really good kid and he doesn't do it, but he knows he's just going to have to grind and grind if he wants to carry on playing or give up. And it does make me really frustrated that seems to be a real direction that games are still going in more and more as we're talking about the future of games. And whereas his mum would be more than happy to spend $3.99 on a game for him every couple of months.
We need to get one of those like workplace safety signs to put up on the website. It has been 2 weeks since someone on the podcast complained about paywalls in mobile gaming.
And then it flips back to zero.
Saying that, I spend a lot of in-game money on Flow Free. I spent so much money buying hints as I replay that game 800,000 times. So, you know.
I don't know Flow Free. What's that?
It's a very simple puzzle game, and it's just exquisite. There are so many copies of it, and none of them understand why Flow Free is beautiful.
Huh.
Just drawing lines around a screen to fill in all the gaps, and it's absolutely perfect game.
Well, I just bring it up and I see the screenshot and I'm like, yeah, I could make that, which is a sign that it's like, I really don't understand, obviously, what...
That's the thing. I won't go into the details of why the clones don't understand why that game's perfect. But yeah, it's beautiful, and I've given ridiculous amounts of money to them, and I'm glad to have done it.
It's interesting that hints is their main, and like it says right there, top in-app purchase is 5 hints for 99 cents, or as they convert it into Canadian dollars just because of... It's funny, $1.19. Yeah, that's interesting. Maybe I'll check that out. Or maybe I shouldn't check it out because it sounds like it may drain my iTunes account.
Yeah, I have played a little bit. I didn't get sucked into it as much as you clearly did, but it's definitely an excellent game, Flow.
I think I'm playing it through for the 8th time now.
Make the note there. So we talked a bit about early access and Kickstarter and all these sort of indie games, which I'm sure we'll come back to. But something that people used to talk a lot about is the evolution of AAA games on the PC or maybe devolution, in that I'm not entirely sure, that I don't have the stats in front of me, of whether or not AAA game sales on PC have been decreasing or if it's just that they've been increasing on the consoles. But is that something that there's like any amount of consensus on, that the PC is more and more going to be a place for independent games, and then a few developers like Blizzard that do focus on the PC, and that the sense of the sort of big AAA blockbusters focusing on the PC because they have the high-end graphics and stuff is just kind of a thing in the past?
My understanding is that if you make a cross-platform game, between 5-10% of your sales will be on PC. That sounds low, but it's a really significant portion of your sales, so it's still definitely worth having. It's 5-10% of money you wouldn't be getting otherwise. So I think there's always going to be the mainstream AAA games appearing on PC. I don't think there's very little chance that if you're not tied into an exclusive contract with Sony or Microsoft, that you wouldn't. You may as well. It's so easy to port, especially now that the PS4 and the Xbox One are basically PCs. It's so much easier. It's so easy to port to PC, stick it on Steam and make a whole ton more money. So it's bad business not to make a PC version of your game.
A significant percentage of games from a development standpoint are already running on the PC. Like almost any game studio that's doing a cross-platform game, like there are probably some game studios that are doing single-platform games that it only runs on that platform, but certainly for cross-platform games, always at Radical and at every other company that I'm aware of, they've had a PC build of the game running for development purposes, right? Because it means that you don't have to necessarily give everyone a piece of the development game hardware in order for them to be able to do stuff in the game, right? That you can say, all right, all the artists, we're not just going to give every single artist a development kit. Some of them will just integrate their art into the PC build and look at it there, and then we'll look at it all on the console in the big end of milestone review. It's just it's an easier way to do some of that stuff. And at that point, I think for something like Prototype, which was the last game that I worked on that had a PC SKU, basically the work involved in shipping the PC version was like 2 people, 3 months or something like that, in terms of effort that wasn't put into the rest of the game. So, and even though that game did sell abysmally on the PC, like it was definitely at most 10% of the console sales. I think it was actually significantly less than that. But it was still, I mean, it was still probably profitable to make the game on the PC, though only barely, just because it was so little effort.
That was the one that sold poorly enough. I heard a rumor from someone in the industry, unsubstantiated, that sold poorly enough that there was a bug fix release they wanted to make that they didn't want.
Yes.
Like the publisher didn't want to pay for QAing it, even though it fixed like a fairly major bug. I can't remember what it was, but
yeah, they did. They didn't release a patch that we did for that game, even though we had the patch ready to go, and they were just like, "Nah, it's not really worth QAing it to fix those problems," because there was, you know, a few tens of thousands of sales of that SKU. But I mean, like I said, even at a few tens of thousands of sales, I think it didn't make back the money of development. It's just they didn't think they were going to get any more sales out of patching it, which they're probably correct about. It just, as a developer, it sort of pissed me off that was the call, particularly when we'd said, you know, we really shouldn't be shipping a PC version of this. Like, it's not gonna sell well enough to justify it.
I think a prototype was it was just too early for action adventures to be really ubiquitous on PC. It's now so normal for everyone to have a 360 pad or similar plugged into their PC, and I think 2009 was just too early for PCs to be quite ready for it.
Yeah, and there's thing. I mean, this is something where more time would have helped specifically with that game, is that the mouse and keyboard control scheme was not very good, and we knew that. Like, it wasn't like we were in denial about the fact that it was hard to play with the mouse and keyboard, but that was something that we just didn't. We didn't have the time and budget to fix. You know, we could do the work to get the game running and have like the, you know, it functions on the PC and it's got like, you can set the video options and you can switch your controllers and stuff like the stuff that you couldn't ship without it. But we got the mouse and keyboard control scheme working, and we're like, all right, you can play the game like this. It's not amazing. Like, what are we going to do? And there just wasn't, we didn't have a clear path of like, here's how we fix that problem. And it wasn't like they were going to give us a bunch of extra money to spend another month just tuning the control scheme on the PC. So it got sent out with a crummy control scheme on the PC. And like, you know, there's only so much you can do about that. Like,
I'm going down the list now on Steam, looking at the top sellers, the top selling games, and trying to figure out which, like, what the proportion is of games that are console SKUs and then also selling well on Steam. I was actually surprised how high, like, I'm maybe looking at, like, maybe the Canadian version of this, or maybe this is everything, but Grand Theft Auto 5 is the top selling game on
Steam. That's months before it's out.
Yeah.
It slipped to March. It's end of March now. It slipped to.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Interesting. So, obviously something that a lot of people have played on console, but a lot of people are paying for it at Steam at $70 or $70.
Yeah, it's £40 on the UK version, which is, you know, £10 more than the average PC game. So for that to be the number one based on pre-orders is, as I said earlier, depressing and also extraordinary.
Yeah, but interesting, at least, like, definitely that's, you know, poster child AAA game selling well on Steam. Although if you go down the list, there's not much else on here that I would...
We've got Dying Light next, which of course is cross-platform as well. But then, then it starts getting... Stranded Deep, which is an interesting one. I would describe it as a barely started game. And it's a lot of potential survival sim. That's something that is defiantly PC. If you release that on console, there would be uproar because there's almost nothing to do in it at the moment.
Is Stranded Deep the one where, like, you have a submarine and you're...
No, this is yet another basic survivalist. So you're in a plane crash at the start, very much like The Forest, but you land in the sea and you swim to a local island. You paddle your life raft to a nearby island and then you set about trying to survive. But mostly you're trying to survive the bugs at this point.
Bugs. Excellent. Sounds like a lot of fun. And it has made $1 million on Steam. I'm sure if it's number three on the list of top sellers, it's definitely made. That's hilarious. And then, of course, Football Manager 2015 is high on the list because of all the Americans being very excited about the Super Bowl, simulating their team's win. I'm just kind of scrolling down. I guess Lego The Hobbit, I'm sure. The Lego games are on here. They must obviously have console sales. But yeah, a lot of the things on here are indies and early access, Kerbal, and things that started on PC, like Binding of Isaac and stuff like that.
I have to break this to you. Football Manager is your British soccer.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, that's
assumed.
I know. It's the Brits keeping that one afloat.
Oh, wow. I'm clicking through this now, and it's like just totally simulation. Like, I guess there's obviously the 3D, like you watch the game, but just pages and pages of stats and defending physical skill and little diagrams where you can set your plays, I assume. Oh, wow.
I would rather pull my own ears off than play this.
That is kind of a side point, but football, in the British sense of the term, like it's difficult as a North American to sort of get that. But I mean, that happens in all sorts of genres. It's like FIFA is by far the best selling of EA's sports games.
Yeah, which is always surprising.
Does it outsell Madden?
Actually, maybe Madden is close, but it certainly doesn't. I think FIFA's the best selling. I think it does sell better than Madden. I'm not 100% sure about that because I hadn't thought of Madden in my list. I know FIFA sells way, way better than like the basketball or the hockey or any of those ones do. But I hadn't thought of Madden. Madden may actually be better. Or close.
Wikipedia has FIFA well ahead of Madden.
Oh wow, wow!
Yeah, it has it ahead. It's in number 9 of all time best selling franchises, ahead of Lego. And then Madden is actually it's actually not far. It actually has FIFA as 100 million estimated, and Madden is 99. Funnily enough,
wow.
So, but then Tom Clancy, Assassin's Creed, Legend of Zelda, Gran Turismo, these are all lower in number of copies sold than FIFA.
Yeah. It's huge. It's because everyone other than North America basically really deeply cares about that to the exclusion of all other kinds of sports, right? That, you know, football games and basketball games and stuff like that just go nowhere in Europe. And it's, you know, it's a big enough market that when there's that much of a skew of people wanting football games and not wanting American football / hockey / basketball / whatever.
Well, there's an EA office, a fairly large EA studio here in Vancouver, and there was all these like really negative, nasty rumors, which I'm pretty sure they're just true, that the reason that NHL 2015 is so like infamously bad and took out a lot of features and was obviously not done is because they took a bunch of people from the NHL team and put them on the FIFA team. And there's a lot of Canadians who are like, that's so ridiculous. Why would we take people off the most important game in the country and put them on this like random soccer game, which is selling probably 10 times as many copies as NHL?
Yeah. And yet they don't make a baseball game, which is the only good sport.
Well, that's pretty sad. I didn't realize. I guess I just not really thought about the fact that they don't make a baseball game. But yeah, the NHL series is not even on this list of best-selling game franchises, which goes on for like pages and pages and pages.
NHL 95 was the only one you ever needed, so there's no point in buying one after that.
Well, the awesome thing is they include like an NHL 95 mode now.
Oh, wow.
People said that the main mode was broken enough that the game was mostly useful for that. Oh, man, that's amazing. I don't remember what the original point of all that was, but oh, just that they own AAA games on PC, yeah. And obviously they're still going to be a long-term thing to some degree, even if it's, you know, making this, remaindered income on it off of Steam as the game slowly gets older, and there's all the good old games and all these sites that keep selling PC games much longer than, I imagine that the PC game sales over time graph is way longer than the console one. Like how many, you know, copies of PlayStation 2 Grand Theft Auto are getting sold today? Probably very, very, very few.
Although digital distribution, as it changes many things, may change that to some degree on the consoles, right? That one of the limiting factors in shelf life is physical shelves. That, you know, up until a couple years ago, you needed a game store to put a box copy of your game on the shelves. And, you know, there was a point below which nothing was going to be profitable to keep on the shelves. And that, you know, that point changes with digital distribution, and it changed earlier on the PCs than it did on the consoles. That digital distribution has been the norm on PCs, you know, for at least the last 5 or 10 years, and was even starting to become a thing before that. Whereas on the consoles, it's really only now that we're starting to see the transition, right? That there's plenty of people with PS4s and Xbox Ones that digital distribution is their main or only way of purchasing games, which is not something you saw basically at all with the previous round of consoles. And that'll extend the shelf life, the virtual shelf life of those games, that people will be, there's no cost to the publisher then really to keeping them in stock, right? So they'll be sold longer. And once the console generation rolls over, there'll be issues with keeping that stuff alive. Though even there, you can go on the, you know, on the PS4, you can go on the like streaming PS3 games service and get a significant percentage of PS3 games.
Well, that's actually something interesting I hadn't thought of, which is that as the shelf life for PC games, quote, quote, shelf life, the sales life of PC games lasts pretty long time. Like people are buying especially like RTSs and these sort of stuff on Steam that are 5 or 8 years old and they still play, and that's fine. But eventually it falls off the end of kind of the cliff in the end for a lot of Windows games, that they just don't run on modern Windows or modern graphics cards, or they have various problems, which people work around. But, you know, the games start to kind of, it's easier for them to fall apart with age as technology changes. Whereas I would imagine for consoles, it's easier for them to set up, okay, here's how we emulate a PS2. And this is exactly how PS2 worked, and we can fully emulate it, and like sort of the way that like arcade games live on, that we're running on this particular like Zilog Z80, and then they just simulate it, and then for probably an arbitrary amount of time, people can keep playing this game. Whereas fully simulating, you know, Windows 95 would be much more problematic licensing wise, and also just an unpleasant thing to build.
Yes, I've made virtual machines to be able to install Windows 95 games. It's a lot of work and not much fun. Whereas you've got good old games who are going through and working with publishers to make the games run, and there's DOSBox for even older stuff. A lot of publishers re-releasing their games with DOSBox versions.
So what does good old games do when they're... Because I know that they, you know, obviously are selling a lot of old PC games that are, you know, past maybe not even when you would assume that they would work. But what are they doing with the... Are they actually, like, releasing patched versions of the game to bring them up so they run on, like, Windows 9 and stuff like this? Or not?
That's
Windows 9, Windows 8, Windows 10?
Yeah, they that's basically what they're doing, is they're especially patching the executables and stuff so the Windows can recognize what it is it's trying to launch. But for the older stuff, there's DOSBox, which a lot of them are running through, which is essentially an emulator for DOS. And that way you can run, you know, your Wing Commanders and your 90s point-and-click adventures. Well, 90s point-and-click adventures go much more nicely through ScumVM, obviously. But there's lots of different ways of emulating that stuff. And it's can be, because it's free software, they can then incorporate it directly into the game. So when you run your copy of, Dark Forces or whatever from GOG, there's a good chance it'll boot up using some sort of emulation.
Right. I imagine actually there's a discontinuity where it's a lot easier to deal with that up to Windows 95 kind of era. And then like you're not at the point where Microsoft will give you a license for Windows 95 to bundle into your game. Although maybe one day it'll be like, yeah, whatever, who cares?
It's interesting what you were saying about Tails and consoles. It occurred to me that Nintendo have been bizarrely ahead on this one in terms of, they figured out a way to get a tail on Game Boy games with their consoles. It's weird that Microsoft and Sony haven't done similar. You could think of the classics they could dig out of the Xbox and PS2 era that they could then just sell as, for massively inflated prices like Nintendo does.
Oh, yeah. And like the Wii Virtual Console started with like selling NES and SNES games. And I think that the ability, the Wii not being a very strong console, but it's definitely plenty strong enough to simulate an NES or an SNES. Whereas I think for Microsoft, for an Xbox One to simulate original Xbox, it definitely, I'm sure it can, but there's less extra overhead. And also the Xbox, original Xbox, I believe, was not an x86. It was like PowerPC architecture. And so there's
the original one was an x86. Like,
and then PowerPC
the 360. The Xbox... full stop was an x86, and then the Xbox 360 was a PowerPC.
Right. So that's the sort of thing that, you know, you can imagine it making more, not impossible, but more work for them to get it. And then also larger downloads and stuff, whereas Nintendo probably can spend almost nothing on, like, you know, there exist NES emulators. And I remember someone was accusing one of the major publishers from packaging a GPL'd emulator. Like there's like some suspicion they were using like one of the one of the open source emulators for Virtual Console. I can't remember if that was substantiated, but someone had like, oh, there's this glitch in this emulator that I wrote that is now showing up on Virtual Console or Sony's thing or one of these, which I thought was pretty funny.
I think part of the reason why Nintendo has been able to be ahead of the curve of that is just more people have been interested in emulating the Nintendo consoles because people are more passionate about the old Nintendo games, right? That it's not, there's no real technical challenges in emulating an Xbox or a PS1 or PS2 on a modern machine, but there haven't been as much effort put into those emulators by the community because people are more passionate about the older games. And there's, you know, there's sort of a complexity threshold that it crosses of it's, you know, it's harder to emulate that stuff, not in the sense that the machines aren't powerful enough to do it. They're plenty powerful, but just as the machines get bigger and more complicated, it's more work to write the emulator for them. So someone, you know, someone can just kind of go in their spare time and write a, you know, an emulator for something like an NES, which is a really simple machine architecturally, whereas an emulator for a PS2 is a bit more effort, and there's less people who have the skills and the desire to do it, and then there's not as many games that people are really interested in running from that era as there are from like the NES, SNES.
Well, there's that hole at the early 3D where you get games where like at the time is like, whoa, it's 3D, but the main appeal was, whoa, it's 3D, as opposed to like this is a, you know, there's not a lot of people clamoring to simulate Bubsy 3D from like the PlayStation 1. So
I can see why people would put more effort into getting an old Zelda working than Blinks the Cat.
Yeah, exactly. But then over time, that's going to start, you know, the curve will return again as we start looking at PS2 and PS3 games. You know, we are lucky enough that we got some remastered stuff that were like late era PS3 games coming to PS4 and stuff like that. But there's always going to be these classics, you know, like I am now, when I think of classics, I think of like, you know, Journey and first person, or not first person, first party Sony games, and then like PC games like Portal 2 and stuff like that, which I'm sure will be available for a long time. But you know, there will definitely be more in demand, I would say.
It'll also be interesting to see if the hardware has a little bit more longevity. Like I think that's another thing that's different now versus the NES, SNES kind of era is, I think people are a little more aware of this stuff now, of like, hey, I might want to go back and play old games, and are more willing to hold on to their old hardware to do that rather than just kind of moving on. And then a couple years later, regretting like, oh, I really should have held on to the NES so I could play the original Super Mario Brothers. I think that you may get that I know way more people that still have like their GameCube or their PS2 kicking around somewhere and can haul it out and play their library than I knew people who had their NESs or SNESs still kicking around in the like PS1, PS2 kind of era.
Can I ask, Nigel, how long do you see this generation of consoles lasting?
I don't know. It's tougher to judge not being inside it anymore, but it seems like everyone was kind of happier with the last generation being longer, you know, that both developers and publishers and even gamers like sort of liked the fact. So I would sort of assume that this one's going to last more like the length that the last one did, like the eight, nine years kind of area, as opposed to like the 4 or 5 year cycles that we were getting for a while there. But I don't really have anything other than like a gut feeling to judge that on. Like I don't have any inside information about it.
Because that's the thing that could hurt the future of the PC. The PC has done so well in the last few years because of an end of a console generation and the beginning of a new one. There's this weird cycle. So at the end, the developers who want to do top-end stuff are frustrated that they're using decade-old tech. And so they look at the PC and think, oh, great, we can push things way further here. And then in the launch of a new console era, no one wants to make games for them in the first year because they haven't figured out the new tech. And so the PC shines there. Where the PC was most hurt was in the peak. I think about 5 or 6 years into the last console generation, where everyone knew exactly how to get the very best out of it. And they're thinking, you know, this is all sorted now. And the PC, I think, suffered for that. So if this does become another 8 to 10 year cycle, I think PCs could be finding tough times in about 4 or 5 years' time.
I think the other issue that PCs are going to have is that the current crop of consoles seems to be much more indie friendly than the previous round were. Like that, I think a big part of the resurgence of the PC the last little while has been driven by the indies. That the fact that people could make these games that you just couldn't, you couldn't ever make them reasonably on the consoles. Like you wouldn't, you know, it would be too much of your development budget just to get development hardware to put them on a console to bother. And the, you know, it was enough of a niche market that you need to find all the people that have got that. And you, you know, you can assume that they've all got Windows PCs. And so if you can get a hold of them and you're publishing your game on a PC, then they'll have some PC that's capable of playing it, as opposed to if you're making it for a console, okay, well, how many of the consoles do we need to support to reach everyone? So, I mean, to me, that's like the thing that has been interesting on the PC the last couple of years has been the indie games. You know, I used to be a much bigger PC gamer. And then when I sort of got into console, I stopped and switched to Macs as my PC platform. I stopped doing PC gaming. In the last little while, I've definitely been getting more stuff on the PC. And it's been because there's been these kind of interesting indie games, not because I'm like, oh, I really want to play the latest FPS with a mouse and keyboard. Like, yeah, I know it's better, but I've gotten used to doing it on the consoles. Whereas there are indie games, like you can't get Stanley Parable on, you know, on consoles, right? You, at least I don't think you can. but there, I mean, certainly there's games like that that are just, they're sort of smaller experimental titles. They're only on the PC and they're worth getting there for that reason. So I think if the PC gets hurt by this console generation, it will be because that kind of stuff finds a bit more of a home on the consoles, which I do feel like is happening to some degree.
I think that I agree, but I think there's still a barrier that there is. Sony and Microsoft both still have to change their thinking in a significant way to win over a lot of indies. So at the moment, the way they're winning indies over is coming to them saying, hey, if you make your game, you know, 6 months just for us, we'll give you a whole bunch of money and you can make your game a bit better. And for some indies, that's exactly what they need. And they sign a 6 month exclusivity with Sony or whatever. And they, I think what's happened is a lot of them have found out that's not a good idea. They alienate, you know, most of their PC fan base because they can't play the game, and they alienate whichever console they didn't go with. And I think as indies are recognizing that these exclusive deals aren't in the end that good for them. And at the same time, you've got the battles with, you know, Microsoft keeps screwing up with their relationship with the indie developers. And I think they've got to have a mind change and understand that what PC offers is utter freedom. There's no one saying, and you know, we get this 5%, 10%, 30%. There's of the Steam is taking 30%. I recognize that, but it's avoidable. I think Microsoft and Sony if they want to compete and if they want to steal away indies from PC, they're going to have to change their minds in a way that I think, as massive corporations, they're going to really struggle to do.
Yeah, that's definitely plausible. Like it's certainly not a slam dunk that they can take that market. And I think it would be, in some ways, it would be good if they didn't, because I think if consoles do steal indie gaming away, it won't all go right. What'll happen is there'll be some diversity lost in that transition, that there'll be a certain, you know, there'll be some more mainstream indie stuff that will make the transition and that will probably get better production values and bigger sales and stuff out of moving to consoles, and the stuff that's left behind will probably wither away, because there won't be, you know, if people are just in the mindset of like, oh, I just download everything on my PS4 and I don't ever fire up Steam anymore, then the stuff that had to stay on Steam will suffer for that, which I think would suck. Like, I think
it'd be pretty bad for me too. I'd be out of the job.
So I kind of hope that won't happen. I think the resurgence of PC gaming in the last little while has been obviously it's a good thing for people that are primarily PC gamers and for people that are, you know, there are these indie developers, but I think it's a good thing for the industry as a whole to have that, like, credible, you know, credible other platform available. And, And a place that people can be more experimental and produce a wider range of different games than what you see on the consoles. Like the,
The indie games is definitely one place that all the experimentation is getting in, like on simpler games and old style 2D games. But on the opposite end of the spectrum, you have like the Oculus Rift, where like consoles are maybe not even powerful enough yet to run like good latency, fully immersive VR games. But people want to experiment with that and see, you know, what's possible in this new medium, basically. And you need a pretty beefy PC to get good frame rates on that. And so the existence of the PC and the health of the PC game market and Steam and things like that make that a lot more viable than if it was like, well, we only have consoles, so I guess we just need to make Oculus Rift as good as the whatever the latest console generation can handle and then wait in 8 years until the PS5.
Well, on the PC, someone other than the console manufacturer can make that, right? Like a third, like you could make something as good as Oculus on the consoles, but only Sony could make it for the PS4 and only Microsoft could make it for the Xbox One. And Sony's working on that. Like they've got, Microsoft has their HoloLens thing, but who knows if that ties in with the game. But certainly like Sony is actively developing a, 3D VR add-on for the PS4. No question. But only they can do it. Whereas on the PC, because it's open, someone else can do that. Someone else can try and make a go of it and try the concept out better and solve some of the problems in advance and find out if it, find out if it works. Like I'm sure Sony is very carefully watching the stuff that Oculus is doing to try and determine if they're actually going to ship Project Morpheus or if they're going to let it wither away.
As I have no real reputation to worry about, I'm happy to put it on the line and say that I'm fairly certain that Oculus Rift and whatever the console manufacturers come up with will in 10 years time be one of those. Hey, do you remember when they tried to do just like every other VR experiment?
Interesting. So that's not, I guess that is a controversial thing, but that's not very common that people go out there and say that they're pretty confident that it's effectively what you're saying is that it's a fad. You're sure? Okay.
Awesome. I really, and I say this purely because I think two things. One, people aren't willing to wear a really big, stupid plastic thing on top of their head. Yeah. And two, they're not good enough. They're just not quite good enough.
So I have only done the demos. I haven't really played like an immersive game. But my feeling from it was like, okay, this could eventually be something that would be good enough. Definitely like the dev kit 2 and the demo where you sit there and there's like you're floating, falling, and objects are moving around. Like, okay, that's not enough for make me wear this. But the immersion was stronger than I expected it to be. And from what I've seen from John Carmack and these guys talking about what's necessary for full immersion, it seems like they need maybe another like 50 or 100% more power to really get this like 120 frames a second, 5 millisecond latency, and then also interesting gameplay.
Well, that's the point. That's the gameplay is where it falls apart. And to have any major publisher be willing to invest the vast amounts of money it would take to create a game elaborate and deep enough to make this novelty worthwhile would be such a gamble on their part. I really see them being reticent to try it.
Definitely for something that's totally new and everyone's talking like, oh, well, we just don't know what VR games are going to be like. The really good VR game just hasn't even been thought of yet. But the impression that I get from talking to people is that if you develop a AAA title where you're in a first-person view, so like let's say you're piloting a battle mech or racing or something like that, then it doesn't need a lot of VR-specific changes made to it to make it a pretty amazing experience on the high-end prototypes that have yet to leave the offices of Oculus and Valve.
I can see Oculus becoming the norm for buzzy, super rich corporations wanting to have boardroom meetings around the world. But I can't see the difference between what I'm hearing now and what I heard in the 90s with people saying, oh yeah, the VR, the tech's not quite there. It's just a bunch of weird polygons and the only game we've got is one where you're this polygon man walking down the street. But in a couple of years' time, I don't hear any different words this time.
Well, it's a little better than the Virtual Boy.
No.
But yeah, no, I definitely, the skepticism, it's like the fool me once, shame on me you know, or shame on you, fool me three times or however many times VR has come around. Healthy skepticism is definitely good, I think.
There's always the risk, though, with that attitude of if the barriers to adoption are just technical, those are going to be solved eventually, right? Like, whether it happens this go-round or not, there's no question that eventually the point can be reached where all of those technical limitations can be brushed away and it will be completely immersive. And so really the question is, okay, once those limitations are brushed away, is there something compelling enough there that people are going to, you know, are going to go for it? And is this time around the time that all the technical limitations are gone? And, you know, I haven't used any of the current crop of them, so I've got no information to judge on whether or not they're, you know, whether or not they've crossed that threshold, or whether they're close enough to that threshold that they can get over it with this, you know, with this round of development, that if they keep working on it for another couple years, they'll have something that's good enough that it's completely immersive.
Yeah. Well, I think the will they get good enough question is, we can't answer that, like, we can only guess, but I think we can at least theorize, like, on a Syracusan timescale, VR will eventually, technology will get good enough that when you put the thing on, it's visually indistinguishable from real life. So I would ask John, do you think that when it gets that good, is there something compelling there? Or is it just fundamental, like putting a dumb looking thing on your head and sitting and using any control scheme is never going to be really mainstream because it's just too hokey?
I think the same barrier comes in as I think comes for 3D TV, in the sense that when I sit and watch a TV program, I don't sit there thinking, well, this is all very good, but why is everyone completely flat and the background as close to me as the foreground? My brain is perfectly capable of dealing with the perspective on a flat screen. And 3D movies and all this, as far as it seems much more likely it was just a way of forcing cinemas to switch to digital than actually the next direction for cinema. There's no conspiracy to go with that on gaming, but I don't struggle for immersiveness when I'm playing a game on my flat monitor. I don't sit there thinking, how am I supposed to know how far away that thing is to shoot at? It's not poking, it's a big stick out the screen toward me. And in the same way that you don't need books with LED lights dancing around the side to be able to understand what the words are saying, you don't need 3D to enjoy a game. And I think that's the biggest barrier. It's got to be worthwhile in some way that my imagination doesn't already take care of.
Yeah, my thing that I'm hesitant on it, and I think that, you know, I'll just have to roll with wherever technology goes on this, but I, as somebody who does not live alone, the idea of completely immersing myself in something that I can't see or hear anything around me is highly antisocial and probably not very fun for the other people who live with you and need to maybe ask you a question or interact with you in some way. But then when you get to having kids, then you can imagine that being even more problematic, that, you know, basically you have the dystopian people plugged into a jack and just kind of drooling in the corner where the world is happening and maybe crumbling around them. And that's just, you know,
so what you're saying,
emotional thing.
But what you're saying is John Carmack is trying to bring about existence.
Yes, that is exactly what I'm saying.
What I can see is I can see there being some experiences that are compelling enough to justify, you know, to justify the technology in the same way that, like, you know, there are some experiences right now that are compelling enough to justify, like, putting together big motion control rigs so you can simulate, you know, you can simulate motion when you're flying a thing around. But, you know, everyone doesn't go and get, like, a gaming chair that's capable of tilting around to simulate you actually driving. People, you know, build flight simulators if they need to train pilots, or Disneyland puts together rides that use these things. And so, yeah, there's compelling experiences there. That, to me, that seems like kind of the most likely scenario for VR, is that there will come some compelling experiences there that make it worth having. And because it's more portable than, like, buying this big crazy motion control rig, they will sell some of them. But I do kind of agree that I'm not super convinced that all games will be made better by this technology. There'll just be like a few games. And maybe a better analogy in gaming would be like one of those super complicated flight stick kind of joysticks, right? That there's a certain class of gamer and a certain class of game for which those things are awesome, right? But if you're not in that class, you're not going to get one. And it'll just be those few people that are like, yeah, I really like these experiences that are way better on VR. And everyone like looks at them as like, yep, those are awesome. But only a few people will be into them enough to get the hardware. And that, you know, then the question is the threshold going to cross where it's going to be something that's going to sort of break out into the mainstream the way that like instruments did, you know, a 5 years ago with like Guitar Hero and stuff like that, which I guess probably closer to 7 or 8 years ago now, you know, with Guitar Hero and that, where you know lots of people that have them, or are they going to be something like flight sticks where there's like the few extreme flight sim nerds have got one? And if it's the former, then it's probably, you know, the technology is probably going to be sustainable. If it's the latter, then maybe not. Like building a VR headset is enough more complicated than building a complicated flight stick that maybe it's not going to be profitable if like 1 in 1,000 or 1 in 10,000 gamers buys them.
Be cool if I was wrong though.
I like that spirit. I this is going to fail, but it would be cool if it didn't.
Oh, imagine if it worked. That would be great.
Awesome. So, John, where can people go to find out more about what you're up to in the future?
So rockpapershotgun.com is the home of all PC gaming stuff. And on Twitter, I'm at botherer.
Excellent. So I'll link those up in the show notes. Thanks for listening, everybody. We always want to know what you think. So if you have feedback or suggestions for us, especially, you know, critical feedback, it's awesome. Everyone's like, the show is amazing, which makes us feel very good and motivated to keep it up. But if you ever have any sort of ways that you could suggest we can improve the show, or you want to tell us we're awesome, you can send us an email, hello@upup.fm, or even better, leave a review on the iTunes store, and that lets people be able to find the show. So thanks a lot, and see you next time. I'm wondering what John thinks the worst early access game is.
Oh, gosh. Oh, my goodness. That's really hard because there's just so many and I haven't played most of them.
I feel like it would be kind of mean and against the spirit of it, but that there's probably some amazing YouTube channels that just tear apart early access games that are probably hilarious. I haven't gone out and sought them, but I'm sure that there's some.
I think, did War Z release as early access or not? I can't remember.
I think it did. Like, War Z was this one. War Z? Daisy?
It was the War Z, because it was deliberately trying to obfuscate the name to get people to...
Yeah, they thought it was World War Z, but it wasn't. And it was like this semi-copyright violation. And it was just they stuck it up on there and then got a whole bunch of money. And did it end up getting refunded? I don't remember exactly.
No, they renamed it Infestation.
Oh, geez.
And try to keep it going. But yeah, that was probably the worst experience with such a thing I've ever had.
I remember hearing bad things about this game, A New Reckoning. You heard about this?
No. Like, oh, hang on, yeah.
And I looked it up, and apparently it's been renamed Time Ramicide because it was so bad, had such bad press as New Reckoning. But I just kind of
Reckoning
looked
at is a pretty good game title. That other one is not a good game title.
and I go and look at the most helpful reviews, and one of the most helpful is just thumbs down, and the entire review is gift to someone you hate.
Reckoning's about Kingdom of Amulet Reckoning, one of my favorite games that no one built.
Right, yeah, that was one of those ones. I think it's fairly rare that, you know, a lot of people, like critically, got pretty good critical reviews and then was quite unsuccessful financially, which doesn't happen as much in games as it does in film.
Well, it's part of the whole, like, it's part of one of those famous failure stories, right?
Yeah.
Whatever it is, 37 Studio, is that the right name? I can't remember.
That's right.
Some some number. You know, it's like it's up there with
38, like, 38 studios.
38 studios. There you go.
Great name.
it's named after the guy's jersey number,
baseball jersey, yeah.
Player, right? Kurt Schilling. I think that's his name. I could be like, probably now we're gonna get lots of angry emails from baseball fans.
No, it was Kurt Schilling, and it couldn't have been a more apposite last name there.
Yeah, and I mean, that's one of the that's up there with like Daikatana and Trespasser in like the annals of amazing video game industry failures, right? So I mean, it definitely suffered by being part of that, even though everything I've heard about it suggests it was a pretty good game on the whole.
I loved it. It was such a lovely game. I didn't play it till like a year after it all went wrong, but yes, and when THQ collapsed, no one bought it, the license for it. They couldn't even sell the license. But yeah, it was, I mean, that game ended up owing money to the city in which it was made. It was like,
it was that one.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Where there was like some charismatic person running it, like, oh, we're going to change the economy of some somewhere in Massachusetts or something like this. And they got all these loans and, oh man. Yeah,
well, and on the basis, I think largely of this guy being a famous baseball player, right? That everyone's like, oh yeah, that, you know, he's awesome. He's a famous local like sports celebrity, so why not give him a bunch of money to make video games?
$75 million he borrowed from Rhode Island. He was due to pay $1.125 million back on the 1st of May in 2012, and did not
do that.
Yeah. Although you gotta think that $75 million, surely that was like his annual salary while he was pitching.
Well, yeah, but you hear so many stories of professional athletes making so much money that they treat money as infinite, and then they do things like go make a failed video game and realize that money is not infinite, and you can actually spend tens of millions of dollars very quickly.
EA were pretty shitty to it, though. It was EA Partners, and EA Partners wasn't a scheme that worked out so well. Turned out
what was EA Partners?
It was a sort of subsidiary of EA that was working with developers but not owning the title, so they were sort of publishing it without owning it. And
that
as a
sound so bad.
Yeah, it sounds like a good idea, right? But if speaking to people who had who were part of it, turns out that EA thought, well, since it's EA Partners, we don't need to put as much effort into promoting this, and
right.
The consequences were fairly obvious.
Yeah, that's unfortunate.
And I think, yeah, like Reckoning could have, I think it could have sold if EA had put some muscle into it, maybe.
Yeah, that was the one that it was like, in its history, it was like going to be an MMO mm-hmm. and then wasn't. And then they took like the good parts out of it and turned it into, and actually like had like an interesting combat system.
Yeah, just a really neat third person action adventure. And it's just with a massive story in an enormous world. So it feels like MMO scale world. You're playing a single player RPG in, which is great.
Oh, that's awesome. It's too bad. I mean, we're not going to see anything out of it if the IP wasn't. I'm sure someone owns the IP, but if no one picked it up, it's unfortunate. Playing any good games or bad games?
I've been playing a lot of this. My brain stopped. This Stranded Deep. That's what it's called.
Struggling. Deep, that's the one we were talking about before.
That's right. I've been struggling to find the game inside it, and keep like so, because it's, you know, instant permadeath. When you hit a bad bug, there's no getting out of it. So, you know, like going into it, or even just bad design, like they've got shipwrecks to explore. And if a shipwreck is beached, oh, brilliant, I'll go in. I went down into the hull and was looking around and then realized it's not underwater, so I can't swim back out. And they haven't thought of that. And that's that entire adventure ruined.
That's unfortunate. The screenshots look nice. It looks kind of fun.
Oh, it's very pretty. There's loads of potential. They released it on Early Access way too early. They didn't put nearly enough game in. And the game they have is so hidden. You try to find, the crafting system is a really nice idea. Rather than having a menu in which you craft, which is obviously silly, you pick up objects and you drop them on the ground near each other. And when you've got the right combination of stuff on the ground, you can then build stuff with it. That makes sense. Except that doesn't explain anything and you have no idea what's possible to craft, let alone whether you've not got enough of one thing to craft something you don't know about. And so it becomes absolutely dependent upon reading forums and all that sort of stuff.
Can you just put all your equipment in a giant pile and
I
just
did
suddenly
that.
Things will get crafted?
I did that, and of course it's built in Unity and the physics can't cope with
oh,
that.
No.
So every individual object trying to interact with every other object.
So they start vibrating?
Sorry, say again?
Did they start? That's an infamous thing in like crappy game systems. I'm sure Nigel could explain why this happens. But if you put a large number of physics objects in a small area in a lot of game engines, it'll start vibrating because it cannot actually find a settled position for them all.
They did. It's something even better. It starts vibrating, and then in the distance, a shark flew out of the water. Which is up there with my Soldner, the great Soldner, probably the greatest game ever released. It was a German first-person shooter. It was meant to be a multiplayer game, but it was released in the most abysmal state. And I've got copies of it that were never ever removed from my hard drive because I've never booted Soldner and not had a wonderful time. My favorite moment: I was going toward a building, and there were two tanks. Enemy tanks by this building. One of them was driving around and around in circles around the building in infinite circles. The other was just repeatedly ramming itself against one of the walls. The one going in circles eventually drove into a giant fuel container, exploded, and then in its place was a man in a Jeep wearing a red beret.
Oh,
that was
man.
Beautiful. Tom Francis of Gunpoint and PC Gamer fame, he was playing, he jumped through a window and the entire building exploded. Those are the kind of bugs you leave in a game.
These are actual bugs. It's not like a goat simulator, like purposely bad kind of thing.
No, it's just incredible bugs. And a team of dedicated hardcore players who decided they could see the good in this game keep desperately trying to patch it. And it's like, no, it's perfect as is. Don't touch it.
There's a certain part of me that likes this. One of the people that we've actually had on the show previously, Justin, who did Desert Golfing and No Breaks Valet and some of these games embraces this like sort of purposely bad aesthetic, and like Go Simulator definitely did this. And there's a certain part of me that thinks it would be fun to make one of those games. And it's definitely easier than making a super polished game where you just focus on making it like it's chaotic and broken, but in a way that's fun and unexpected, fun, interesting things happen. Ideally, it would be hard to die, but easy to make craziness happen. But I'm not sure if it's as fun if it's intentional.
Well, that's why I'd ask Nigel this. How I would imagine getting it wrong in the right way must be really tough, because most games that are bugged are just boring or frustrating. But to have a game that's bugs are like I will never remove Ashes Cricket 2013 from my computer. I have no interest in cricket whatsoever. But wow, what an extraordinarily batshit broken buggy game that is! Could you do that on purpose?
I'm sure you could try, but it's definitely a fine line to walk of making it broken enough to be interesting. I mean, like the example that we're talking about of Desert Golfing. Like Desert Golfing is a fun game, but like the previous game of his that Alan showed me, the EnviroBear 2000, like it's one of those things where I get what he's going for with it in some sense, but it didn't hold my interest for more than about 30 seconds. It's like, okay, yeah, this is intentionally terrible, and that's awesome, but I'm not going to play a game that's intentionally terrible.
See, I feel like you could take one of these Unity games that's, you know, it's a 3D sort of semi-realistic environment, but give it a plot hook where it's like you're in the Matrix and it's falling apart. Like, you wouldn't call it the Matrix, but like this is a simulation that's falling apart or something like that. And so, like, things start glitching out, and then it gives you this huge license, like, maybe not for being intentionally buggy, but like you can have an area where like you haven't got around to texturing it, especially in early access, and like so it just looks horrible, but like you don't even need to explain it because you're like, oh, the world is kind of screwing up, or like, you know, glitches, you know focus to fixing the glitches where the player dies or gets stuck, but maybe you could, you know, in a game that's trying to be really realistic, when you have certain physics issues, you try to resolve them in a subtle way and not fling sharks out of the water. But you could be like, okay, well, we're much more worried about not killing the player than we are about realism, and so we'll fling things out of each other, and maybe things explode, but you know, you get this ability that you can survive explosions or something like that. Maybe just like lots of things explode, including sharks or whatever. And you know, you could imagine using that as a way for an indie to make a 3D game in a more, you know, cost-effective way, but also explore gameplay situations you would never otherwise be in.
I think there'd be an interesting concept there for like a Stanley Parable style game of like a game that's released on early access and that seems really buggy, but that actually is like a fully polished, tested game that's intentionally buggy and is trying to sort of say something with that. That like,
I've got such good news for both of you. Do you know about the Magic Circle?
No.
This is Jordan Thomas's project. Jordan Thomas of The Cradle in Thief 3 fame. And of course, some of the best bits. He's making a game called The Magic Circle. It's a puzzle exploration game set inside some vaporware.
Oh, God.
That sounds awesome.
As you go around this world, you encounter unfinished parts of the game. You can listen to audio files from the development team and the frustrations and the problems that they had in failing to get certain parts of the game to work. And, you know, this is from the mind behind, as I say, The Cradle and Fort Frolic in Bioshock. So, you know, this guy is an amazing imagination. And it's just, I've had a play of it last year at GDC.
A tale so epic it took 20 years to perfect. The most anticipated game of all time, which is obviously not true, but you're already in the marketing material for the game. You're in the fiction of the game that it supposedly is. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's so cool.
And it's just, I played a little bit at GDC last year and it was so compelling, so weird. And so like it's game within game within game. And you start finding yourself falling down deeper and deeper layers. It's going to be a very extraordinary experience if he can get it right. I really hope he can.
Oh, man, that's cool. I'm excited for that. That makes me feel less intensely like I need to make this. Well, at least I'm curious to see.
Another game, I mean, it's not exactly the same thing, but I'm playing it right now, and it's scratching this itch in the same way that like the Stanley Parable did, or that it looks like this will, is I grabbed the Unfinished Swan because it was on special on download on the PS4. And this is this game where the start of the game is just a completely white screen, basically, and you start out and you shoot these little paintballs and kind of like paint out the game world. And it's got this, you know, it's got this kind of, it's, I mean, it's not really the same thing as that. It's not meta, but you're very clearly inside a story, and there's kind of storytelling aspects and sort of breaks in the story, and there's text from the story appearing in game, and you start out with this completely blank world where you basically have to paint the world to make it navigable in the first section, though later on there, you know, you do get into some sections where there's stuff there. But yeah, there's definitely something appealing about those sort of meta games, like games that are a little intentionally nudge nudge wink wink gamey, that really I quite enjoy more than I expected to.
Did you hear about Rami Ismail's Glitch Hiker?
No.
This was a game, it was designed to die. It was part of the 2011 Global Game Jam.
I have heard about this.
It lasted 6 hours, 52 people played it, and it was designed to break down as it was played. It had a limit to 100 lives. Deaths took away from the game's existence and caused more glitches to appear in it, and it just eventually broke. It's got broken to the point that it was completely unplayable.
I love it.
Which is, I think, just a beautiful idea.
Yeah, I feel there's a few of these like very experimental games as art things, like the game that can only be played once and then deletes itself and things like this. That are interesting, but I think that this idea of bringing that to the masses is more exciting to me. If I was a developer, I would find it unsatisfying. I guess partly because when I make stuff, I'm motivated by people enjoying it, and to the scale that if you add up the total enjoyment of all people, then I feel like that's a big impact on what I made. I'm not quite as artistically meaningful as some people are, I guess.
I think what's nice about projects like that is for the 56 people who did play it, it's part of their life. It's a moment that only they got to share in. And I think there's something, I understand it's commercially perhaps not a brilliant plan, but I like the idea that it's a moment that was only available for a very short time, shared by very few people.
Yeah, apparently when who was it? I'm trying to remember. It was like not Jonathan Blow or one of these like famous game designers or whatever made Rohrer was his name. I can't remember his first name.
Jason.
Yeah, Jason Rohrer, I believe it was, made it for like an IGF game thing. He made a Minecraft mod that you were supposed to play it, and then when you died, you would transfer it to the next person, and they mm-hmm. would play it.
It was a USB stick that would be passed from person to person.
And so the idea was that, you know, when you arrive in the world, everything that's been made, it's like this, the previous generations were like some god that created the world. But then what ended up happening is that the first person who got it auctioned it off, and then the person who bought it just kept it as a keepsake and then never played it. So, womp womp. But yeah, I'm still kind of excited about this glitching idea. Although the Alan getting a game idea and then pitching it to Nigel that we should make something is a pretty common, pretty common thing.
It's sort of the game equivalent of like what you do for some of our clients of yeah. know, people coming in with a iPhone app idea and then you spend an hour telling them why it's not possible. And it's kind of the same thing with you in game design as you bringing a game design concept and then me spending 15 or 20 minutes telling you why it would never work.
As soon as you guys got playable code, let me know, yeah, and I'll write about it.
Oh, I'm excited.
Yeah.